Okay. Thank you, Angela. So it is Tuesday, September 24th, 2024. I believe this is the birthday of my dear old friend Bill, guitar player who I grew up with. However, he's not here with us. He's somewhere. So we're going to begin with a period of meditation, and then something else will happen. So let me just mute everybody there. Okay, so just settling back into your meditation posture. Whatever supports you in being aware, being present. And just feeling the body sitting, feeling the body at rest. Having a sense of releasing any tension, and so we want to relax even as we stay bright and alert. And that's the middle way of practice. And I think it's helpful to take some time to do a bit of a body scan as we begin to sit. Again, to kind of just bring awareness of the body. We spend so much time in our heads, it can take a little bit of effort to really connect with our bodies. Just feeling sensations in your face, your head, relaxing the jaw, softening the eyes. Releasing the shoulders, letting the arms settle. Breathing into the belly, softening the belly, letting the heart chest be open, a sense of receptivity. And feeling the weight of the body sitting. Sensations in the legs, the feet. We can perceive the body in different ways. Can notice individual sensations that might stand out. Other areas might be not felt, not maybe not numb, but just really not much sensation in certain areas. So there's this of breaking down the individual parts of the body. But we can also sense the body as just a single object. We might perceive the body through the elements, the earth, air, fire, water. The earth element is particularly prominent. The heaviness, density of the body. But sometimes we also feel the body as very light. Can feel as well like a field of energy, just many different vibrations and subtle sensations. There's no right or wrong way to be with the body. The point is to have awareness, be present. As the Buddha says, to experience the body as a body. So, not as a concept, not as a thought. But as the living, breathing experience of life. And we use the breath as a central focus in this practice of mindfulness of body. And again, the breath can be felt in many different ways. You can feel the touch of air at the nostrils with the movement, the abdomen, the chest. Can feel the breath as a system. A system that is cultivating different energies in the body, calming, brightening. The breath can be used to modulate emotions, to release tension, to soften. So we become intimate with this movement and experience of breathing in and breathing out. Then intuitively, we learn to use that. Whatever needs we have in a given moment. Whether it's opening or softening. Uplifting or releasing. And always the breath is present. It's always with us. We don't have to be bothered by the wandering mind, by the intrusive thoughts. Just notice them and come back to the breath, come back to the body. Release, settle, breathe. Right then. Morning again. I got a double shot yesterday of the flu and COVID update. So I'm not in my sharpest condition. I did find it amusing that Moderna has now branded their COVID vaccine as Spikevax. I had to laugh that somebody got paid to make up that name. So get your Spikevax. God, Spikevax. So I thought I might read a little bit from the More Than Mindfulness book that I'm continuing to work with. And for a while, this was I was using this for several weeks back in the spring, but had drifted a bit from it. But I've been reading over re repeatedly a chapter from Ajahn Suchito. Ajahn Suchito is a English Buddhist monk. And one of the early people with Ajahn Chah says he went forth as a bhikkhu in Thailand in 1976. So and he has a very distinct style of teaching that's I mean, I think of it as sort of poetic well, anyway, I can't, the words fail me. So I'll just read a little bit of what he's saying. In this chapter is called Breathing Intelligence. It says cultivation of citta is the highest kind of learning, and I think he defines citta later. So, cultivation of citta is the highest kind of learning we can undertake. The breathing body is our means for learning, for directly experiencing our karmic configurations. Provides a basis so when difficult states arrive, a citta can remain open and stable and move through them. This cultivation, bhavana, which is the word we use for cultivation, the cultivation of citta or heart, is the highest kind of learning that one can undertake. This has to be remembered. Learning means you don't quite know. You will find out. You have to explore and feel your way, just like when learning anything else. But this learning is more mysterious and deeper than the learning that your thinking mind undertakes. The thinking mind is often considered to offer the highest kind of learning, but it's always learning about things. When I think about something, I stand outside it and mentally look at it. When I think about myself, I stand outside myself. When I think about practice, I conceive ideas about practice. I read about it in the book or on the screen. I listen to it in the talk. This is learning about practice, isn't it? It's telling us something the way a map does. A map can be good and useful, but it's still a map. It can show you where to go, but it can't tell you how the ground feels and how to walk on it. Yet, this kind of learning, knowing your ground by walking it, is the kind of learning that supports liberation. Liberation can't occur on the map. It's a matter of direct felt experience. It's not about anything. It's here in the ground of your living and changing experience where the obstructions and releases occur. It's on this dynamic ground where skills have to be cultivated. But because we normally operate through conceptual knowledge, directly knowing and working at the ground of liberation can be confusing for beginners and others. Maybe a little bit more. Conceptual knowledge, even the conceptual knowledge of the Buddha, only goes so far. Even the Buddha can only give you the signposts because the ground you're going to cover is yours. It's very intimate and not like anybody else's. It's in the sensitivity of your body and mind, and this sensitivity is configured by the way life has shaped you. So no one else can walk it. What can be taught, however, is that there is a ground that you can walk. There is a way of walking it and certain principles to bear in mind: virtue, calm, clarity, honesty, persistence, resolve, goodwill, mindfulness. On a more personal level, be alert to whether you feel safe and comfortable and what it's like to be free of pressure, obligation, comparing, and self-consciousness. This atmosphere of welcome and integrity is essential as you enter the changeable territory in this body and mind. And then he introduces breathing. He says a supremely useful theme through which to investigate this territory is breathing. By breathing, I mean the flow of energy that can be felt as you breathe in and breathe out. So that sort of takes him into kind of the instructional part of this chapter. But I mean, you can see already just in his voice that it's not sort of mechanistic, you know, it's kind of impressionistic, I think, the way he writes and the way he teaches. And it, you know, sometimes I get lost in his language, but then other times something just kind of cuts through that's just exactly right. So he's a very, you know, kind of inspirational teacher. And I know he has very devoted followers. But he, you know, I've been writing on the felt experience, and that's the title of the piece that I've been working on. And so I actually pulled out this line from here: liberation can't occur on the map. It's a matter of direct felt experience. It's not about anything. And this, you know, puts us, you know, in a somewhat challenging position as we are trying to understand meditation, trying to understand Dharma, trying to understand liberation, as he says. Because, as he says, it's not something we can just read about. We have to experience it for ourselves, which is what meditation is meant to be. And it's so important to practice and come with an open and investigating mind. Now, I gave a talk last Friday in Walnut Creek, actually. Mary Helen was there. Yes, lovely seeing you. And I was really trying to help people to understand what meditation is and what it isn't, because I think a lot of the time we get caught up in it as something that it really isn't, that we kind of get into it on some kind of a mechanistic level, or with an idea that there's a right way to do it and a wrong way, and that we're trying to get something, you know, out of it. And we have maybe a list of goals that we're striving to get. And all of that winds up being a distraction from just being here with the direct experience, which is not always clear what it is, even much less what it means or what's happening. And there's this real challenge to let go of ideas about what we're trying to accomplish and let go of goals. Like, okay, I really want to sit down and get peaceful. I really want to sit down and develop insight or what does a 11 step, have conscious contact with the higher power. And all of those are fine things, but the felt experience of it then often gets overlooked. And so I think we have to take that we need to bring kind of an attitude of patience and interest, and particularly let go of judging. I think that comes in so much that, we have these minds that are constantly evaluating, and they're evaluating us and what we're doing. And that evaluation goes along with an expectation or a set of beliefs about good and bad, right and wrong, and correct and incorrect, that we apply to many, many things in our lives. But when we bring it to meditation, this like right and wrong and good and bad, we lose the essence of it. So, I mean, this is something that comes up off fairly often, which is that, meditation is a different kind of activity from ordinary activities. And it's difficult for us when we are so conditioned and trained in a, a system of learning, accomplishing, grading, to step out of that model of scoring ourselves, grading ourselves. Insight is subtle. It's not doesn't come with an alert on your phone or some sign in the sky that tells you, oh, I just had insight into impermanence, It demands this kind of surrender to just what is happening, and letting go of trying to figure it out. And if you're getting it, what I remember when I in my early days of practice, I really had this sense of like, where is my insight? Like, what's wrong with me? I'm not getting this. And then after some retreats, I remember reading some Dharma and seeing that I understood it now in a way that I had not before I had practiced in a serious way. And I realized that I had had insight. And one of the problems here being translation, as it often is, that what insight means in Buddhism is not an idea that you now understand. It's much more like a felt experience that's not, and it's certainly on a nonverbal level. It originates certainly on a nonverbal level. It can become understood on a verbal level, but that's another stage or step in that process. And much of the time, that I think that comes further down the line in kind of this process of growing spiritual maturity, growing wisdom, that we often don't realize that we have until something brings it to our attention. But as I say, it's often through hearing the Dharma or reading the Dharma that I realize that I understand something. And this is something that I say to people as well. I can remember someone saying to me, "Oh, you gave me so much insight when you said something." And I said, "No, I didn't give you insight. You had that understanding, and I would just let you know that by saying that, I revealed the thing that you had experienced on a felt level, and that was now and brought it more into a conscious realization that, and as I say to people, if you walk up to, an ordinary person in the street and tell them something, that's like Buddhist insight, they're just gonna shrug and walk away. It's not gonna mean anything to them because they haven't had the experience for themselves. And that's how we know that, oh, yeah, I've had this experience. I mean, it's the title of Joseph Goldstein's first book, The Experience of Insight, which that alone is a very, when you think about, when you analyze that title, it doesn't make sense in English. In English, an insight, as I understand it, is not an experience, it's an idea. And that title points to the fact that actually, in Buddhist terms, vipassana, insight, is an experience. So we see this the most direct way. I think we can see this. One of my favorite ways to talk about this is how we understand the Four Noble Truths through our meditation experience. That we experience, we sit down to meditate, and we experience dukkha, we experience restlessness, agitation, all the stuff of body and mind that's difficult. And we're trying to, settle the mind. But in that process, when we observe how that is arising, how that agitation is arising, we see that it's arising because of our thoughts of grasping and aversion in the mind. So that, and so what do we do? So that's the second noble truth, right? That's, oh, so we're seeing this. We might not, again, be consciously thinking about it in these terms, but we're meditating and it's like, oh, let me just come back to the breath. This thought is annoying. Oh, and when I come back to the breath, hopefully at times I feel a little bit of relief, because I've stopped obsessing over whatever it was I was thinking about. And that's the third noble truth, that if I stop grasping, that there will be liberation, there will be freedom, there will be at least a moment of release. And then realizing that, oh, what I've been doing here is practicing mindfulness, concentration, effort, right view, right intention. Practicing the Eightfold Path, and that's the fourth noble truth. So we experience this without necessarily framing it in this structured way that the Buddha lays out. But once we hear the teachings and we practice, or once we practice and then hear the teachings, it all makes sense to us. We get it. And in fact, more significantly, even than understanding it, we become naturally inclined to letting go. We see the benefit of letting go. Like, again, in our mainstream, ordinary Western culture, the idea of letting go of anything is not praised. It is not what people aim to. They certainly don't want to let go of anything material, but they also don't want to let go of their thoughts or their beliefs, right? All of this is like very counterintuitive. However, in our meditation, we see for ourselves that clinging to those things causes us suffering, dukkha, some kind of emotional, mental disruption that's unpleasant. And nobody has to tell you to let go of the burning coal. Nobody has to tell you to, like, when you see it, when you observe it, nobody has to tell you, oh, you should let go of that thought. Like, you're not enjoying that thought. When you see it, when you see what's going on, the feeling of it and where it's coming from, you naturally go, oh, let me just come back to the breath. I'm so glad I have this system that I learned from the Buddha to just pay attention to the breath and let go, because it's so freeing and it feels so much better. And so that is insight. That's wisdom. We get sort of, I think we tend to have these inflated ideas about what it means to be, have insight and to have wisdom. And we're kind of like, well, I'm not really that special. I don't have wisdom, I'm not a wise, I wouldn't, I'm not a wise person. But if you have learned to let go of things that cause you suffering, you are wise. Most of the world, just look at it, is going around doing the exact things that will cause them suffering. I mean, it's incredible. It's tragic. But that's, I mean, this is exactly what the Buddha said. Like, this is like what, how people live, that they make the exact opposite choices that they should make if they want to be happy. So that's certainly enough to get us started this morning. If anybody wants to chime in or ask a question or praise my wisdom, praise your own wisdom. Deborah, go ahead.
Good morning. What you talked about letting go, and as I get older and start to downsize and let go of my possessions, I've been watching my other aging friends do the same thing, and how some of them can't do it, and some of them can do it easily, or some of them want to give things away, but they won't give it to that other person who still is kind of hoarding. And it's just it humors me, because okay, so she's hoarding, but maybe she doesn't understand that she too will die someday, but that's her stuff, you know? And if she wants to keep collecting, you don't have to be around to uncollect her stuff, you know? Even if
Right.
it's your stuff that she collected, it's her life, and if she's going to enjoy your stuff, let her. So
Yeah.
be it. That's
Thank
all.
you. Yeah, good example. Thank you. So interesting how we're heading on. Harper, hello.
Hey there.
Hi.
This is my first time coming to this meeting. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for putting it on. But I have a question, not so much about your Dharma talk, but about just the general meeting. And so my question is, so I'm also in Berkeley. From what I understand, at least at one point in time, there was a meeting of this nature, a 12-step Buddhist meeting in Berkeley, but I could be wrong. It seems like this one's on Zoom now, which is fine. But let's see, I'm 32 days clean out of rehab, and I didn't want to work a like an AA step program. I wanted to work a Buddhist step program. So I was just wondering for guidance on if such a thing exists, or how to find like a temp sponsor or a sponsor that like is familiar with your work or is familiar with some kind of Buddhist take on the 12 steps, because it seems like that resonates with me the most.
Okay. Well, sorry. Well, welcome, and good on you being getting 32 days out of rehab. Keep that up. Let's see. I do have a monthly class that I just went back to live at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery. It's on the second Tuesday of each month. I think it's on my website. The Berkeley Buddhist Monastery is at 2304 McKinley Avenue. It's close to the high school. 7:30. You can probably get there at 7:15. So yeah, that's the second Tuesday of each month. And actually, next month I am not going to be there. It's going to be more like a meeting. I mean, I don't call what we're doing here a meeting. I call it a class because, I'm a teacher. But in any case, yeah, beyond that, first of all, we do have a like sign up sheet. Did you put it in? You put it in the chat, Angela. Thank you. It says, "Are you interested in connecting with this community outside of class?" So if you scroll through the chat, there's a bunch of stuff that we put in there. But
Oh, I see. The Google Docs.
yeah. So you might find someone on there who, would support you individually, or someone to connect with. Or maybe hang out here for a while until you feel like you've, heard someone that you feel comfortable with. There is the, recovery dharma. I don't know if you're familiar with that. That's
I'm involved.
okay. And yeah, Angela already put that in there. And if you look at the Buddhist Recovery Network website, they list all kinds of meetings. There are some others that are not recovery dharma, but do this kind of work. I know there's one in Alameda, a regular one in Alameda. So yeah, I would take a look there as well. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, thank you so much for the information.
You're welcome. Thanks for showing up, and keep coming back, and don't drink or use no matter what. Okay. Nice to see you, Harper. Anyone else want to speak today? I
Yeah,
see.
hey, Kevin.
Oh, Mike, hi.
Yeah, hey. So I was just thinking about last night in my men's meeting, we were talking about spiritual awakening. And in what is it, Appendix 2 of the big book, they talk about it being an educational experience sometimes instead of an aha kind of experience.
Right.
And that kind of reminds me of what you're talking about insight. It doesn't have to be an epiphany. I think we kind of build it up into something that it's so big that we can't appreciate that we're having it.
Yeah.
And it's like a lot of the small stuff, like you're saying, just appreciating that, letting go of things that are giving you suffering. I mean, it seems like a simple thing, but it really, like you're saying, it's really an insight. And it just kind of occurred to me there's a little bit of a parallel there, and it just kind of makes me appreciate that
It's a lot of the process stuff that is really important, and we kind of sometimes make things out to be bigger than they are, and we need, if we can just pay attention to the little stuff, it can really help us out. So that's kind of my two cents I was going to throw in.
Thank you. I think that's right. It's not that complicated, right? It really, like, we make it a bigger deal than it is. And yeah, and I think we tend to not appreciate our own, I mean, even using terms like spiritual can be too lofty, but our own wisdom, our own wise, wholesome ways of living. I mean, it's another one of those things that I'm like, it doesn't seem like a particularly spiritual thing to not drink or use drugs, but when it's taken on as a practice, it is a practice of letting go. It's also a practice of living with clarity and living with presence. I went to a baseball game the other day with a friend who's also sober, and I don't know what it was. I went down to get something to eat, and maybe it was seeing all the people buying their beers and stuff. But I came back and I sat down and I looked over and I said, I love being sober. And I talk about it, at times as like that sobriety is a sacred state. And I'm when I say sobriety, it's just a easier to, as opposed to recovery. I mean, it just it's this I'm talking about not using intoxicants and not trying to escape the world, but thinking of it as sacred in and of itself, that I don't have to do anything more. And it is like, and again, all I have to do is look at the world and look at the intoxication of the world, the delusion of the world, the foolishness of the world, to realize that there is beautiful wisdom inherent to this work. Doesn't mean we always feel good or that we're always happy or that everything goes great, but it's still precious. All right, then we have passed the 11 o'clock hour. See this. Oh, I see there's ch little chatting going on there. I'm sorry, I wasn't following the chatting. I'm curious what Flo's link is in there. Oh, my work. Nice to see everyone. Yeah, I'll be around. I guess I'm going to be here for all the Tuesdays. I'm leaving 2 weeks from today. I'll be leaving for the Buddhist Recovery Network conference, but I have an afternoon flight, and I'm hoping that that means that I can still do the morning class. We shall see. If not, we will manage to do something. Meanwhile, I guess I don't have anything going on teaching-wise. So I guess I'll just see you next Tuesday. And if you want to get, you can get the new book, Sought Through Meditation. You can order it now, but I have to, there's a few little tweaks to the design, just the layout, that are going to happen. They allow me to like repeatedly upload and update the book. So if you order it now, you might get the version that, you know, where certain things are on not on the page that I think they should be on, but it'll still be the same book. So in any case, be well. Take care.